Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking about something so esoteric called transporters of biogenic materials. And you might think, what on earth am I going to do for the next 25 minutes listening to this? But then you might think, well, sometimes you get depressed, or you have people who get depressed and friends who get depressed, and they have to take antidepressants. And that's all about the subject that we're going to be talking about today. We're going to be talking to Lynette Dawes. She's a professor at the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio in the Department of Physiology. And Lynette, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. And before we get into antidepressants and transports and all this good stuff, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get into this whole field of science and in particular in physiology?
Okay, well, I could go back many years if you like.
Oh, go back as far as you need to. Right?
I hail from Australia, as you might be able to tell from the way I talk. I'm not a native of Texan by a long shot. I did all my education and graduate training in a place called Adelaide in Australia.
It's my favorite city in Adelaide.
I'm glad you said
so. And it's very close to that wine growing area.
Oh, beautiful.
The Barossa Valley.
Barossa Valley, yes. Has fantastic wines. I miss them terribly.
You can buy them, you know.
You can also get the wines from the McLaren Vale there too. They're equally good. Yes, very, very good. Which is one reason I stayed there for so long before coming to the States. But I guess I had the dream of a lot of young girls, especially, that I wanted to grow up and be a vet, and set about getting an education to meet that goal. And as I went through college, I became fascinated with the neuroscience subject matter and the neuroscience courses that I took, and decided to delay vet school so that I could get an honors degree in neuroscience. And by then I was hooked after I'd done my honors degree.
And that involved a thesis?
Right,
an undergraduate
yes.
Thesis.
So this is, yes, something that's a bit different from Australian education to the U.S.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a one-year mini graduate course, right. I guess, that involves writing a thesis.
But in the end you get an honors degree and a master's at the same time?
Just an honors degree.
Because I know in England, I bring several students from England that do the same thing.
Right.
But at the end of the fourth year, the research they do here counts towards getting a master's degree.
No, in Australia, unfortunately, it's honors, and then you can go on and do a master's, or you can go straight into a PhD program.
Right.
So, of course, I got hooked on neuroscience. And back then, the project I worked on involved studying an animal model of depression. And so I've been interested in depression ever since I started my graduate school.
Animals can get depressed.
Animals can get depressed. I get asked that question a lot. How
do
you tell if an animal's depressed?
How do you tell? I mean, apart from they mope on the floor.
Right. Well, they don't actually mope. You know, we have a lot of behavioral assays we can use to measure indices of depressed-like behavior and anhedonic behavior. So anhedonia means an inability to experience pleasure. Mice and rats love sugar. They love drinking sweet things. But a depressed, you can't see me doing the quotation marks, a depressed animal won't. They'll rather drink water than a sweet solution.
So depressed people are often healthier than non-depressed people? I mean,
I don't know whether it equates to.
I
wouldn't, no, because it's very, there's a lot of debate and controversy in the field about what's a depressed rodent and what's not. So, you know, we can obviously there's the behavioral things you can look for, the behavioral phenotype, but then you can go deeper and you can look at physiological function and whether they have, for example, sleep patterns that mimic those of humans, so delayed onset to REM sleep and things like this, higher cortisol levels, and so on. And so this particular model that I worked with, it was a genetically engineered model and had many of the physiological and behavioral parallels
let's stop there for a minute. So you can then produce and buy these genetically modified animals that lack a certain gene or something like this that then makes them all the time depressed.
Right.
I mean, in this clinical sense that you're talking about.
Exactly, yes.
All right.
Yeah.
And that's not difficult to do.
Not anymore these days. In fact, I'm not molecularly minded at all. And so I depend heavily on molecular biologists to create these types of animals for me. And then I can use them in my applications to study the biogenic amine transporters.
And so the implication is then that when you get people who are clinically depressed, there's usually some genetic feature there that is causing this.
Right.
Can I jump to that quickly?
You can jump straight to that. I think there's very strong agreement in the field, both the clinical and the preclinical fields, that depression is, it's a heterogeneous disorder for sure, but there's a genetic and an environmental component. So you may have genes that predispose you to becoming depressed, but you may not actually ever become depressed unless you have a particular environmental trigger that will precipitate the depression. So one of the most common examples is a stressful life event, highly stressful life event. And if you happen to be carrying the wrong set of genes in combination with that stressful life event, then you're highly likely to become depressed.
So, I mean, is that well understood now that you can go away and get your own genome looked at and then they say, ah, there he is, he's prone to something?
Yeah, we preclinical scientists would love to be able to do that. So with the clinicians too. Unfortunately, there's government law preventing us from doing that, privacy acts and so on. So unfortunately, psychiatrists and clinicians cannot go in and genotype a patient and say, hey, well, you're more likely to become depressed, or this medication is more likely to work better for you because you have this genotype.
I didn't know that. So, I mean, this is a non-legal intervention if we could do it.
Right, we can't do it yet. I think eventually the government will come around to seeing the virtue of this. But at the moment,
people could go out and buy their own genome.
They
right?
can. So there's nothing stopping someone to go and get their own, get themselves genotyped and take that information to their clinician.
And then the clinician can start
right.
to do.
Then they can.
So
use,
it's simply a matter who initiates
right.
the analysis of the gene.
Right. The clinician cannot do it, but if the patient takes that information to the clinician, then that's.
And the clinician can't suggest to the patient, look, this
would
be
sure
a good
they,
idea.
I'm sure they can.
And therefore go and do it.
I'm sure they can.
Yeah.
But
I didn't realize that was not allowable.
No.
All the other tests are. I mean, if I need to know if I got high blood pressure
right.
or too much albumin or God
right.
knows what, all those other things.
Right. There's something, I don't, you know, I'm not on that side of the fence,
okay.
so I don't know the details of it, but there's something about the Privacy Act and apparently knowing someone or finding out someone's genome is too much of an invasion of privacy.
Okay. Okay, so then anyway, you do the animal studies, and of
right.
course every animal study has at the end of the rainbow the fact that you're going to trigger something important for treating people.
Right.
Right.
Right, so that's the goal of.
Now tell us about these transporters then. What is it that's their key to issues like depression?
Right, so these transporters, so there's neurotransmitters in the brain that are heavily involved in a whole slew of psychiatric disorders, and depression is prominent among those. And one of the neurotransmitters most heavily implicated is serotonin. Probably a lot of people have heard of serotonin. It's also known as the mood neurotransmitter. So each of these neurotransmitters has its own transporter. And what these transporters are, they're localized on neurons. And their job is to work like little vacuum cleaners, essentially. So when the neurotransmitter serotonin is released from the nerve, it goes out into the extracellular space in the brain, and then it obviously has to – it'll act on other receptors to exert its effect. But if it gets left out in the extracellular fluid for too long, then you have uncontrolled neurotransmission, which could be a bad thing too.
Because it just wanders all over
right,
the place and starts arriving
exactly.
at places it shouldn't.
It shouldn't. So these transporters.
And is that the cause of depression when it arrives somewhere that it shouldn't be?
Well, now that's a really controversial topic right now, because some people, the dogma for a long time has been that people with depression have low extracellular levels of serotonin. And so these transporters, the serotonin transporter, is the primary target for Prozac. So everyone, I'm sure, has heard of Prozac. And Prozac just blocks that transporter, and it prevents the serotonin from being taken back up into the neuron. And so by doing that, it increases the levels that remain in the extracellular fluid. There's a whole gamut of reasons that I won't bore you with the details now. But many of the animal models we work with now show unequivocally that low serotonin levels aren't necessarily associated with depression, and that these antidepressant drugs like Prozac work, they certainly work by increasing extracellular levels of serotonin, but it seems now very clear that it doesn't matter what your starting level of serotonin is. It's like the change in
okay.
that follows
so
the antidepressant.
It's a totally different mechanism, as you would put
right,
it.
Right, exactly.
On a sort of a question, I mean, I've never taken antidepressants. Do you, as somebody who works with them, ever take them just to see what they do to a normally non-depressed person?
No, I haven't, actually.
I mean,
that would be an interesting experiment. That would be great. It would be a very interesting experiment.
Does it just make normal people happier than they would be normally? Or?
Well, Perhaps. I mean, there's part of my line of research also involves trying to establish the mechanism by which alcohol increases extracellular serotonin. We've known that for many, many years, but no one knows the mechanism through which alcohol is having that effect. And some of our most recent studies have come across another transporter called the organic cation transporter, and it seems that alcohol is acting at that transporter in much the same way that Prozac is acting at the serotonin transporter to elevate extracellular levels of serotonin. And so we think this may play into the reason why at least some clinicians will view certain alcoholics as self-medicating for depression, because they're drinking alcohol and it's causing their serotonin levels to raise the same way as someone taking Prozac. So it could be argued, like you were just saying.
You could go to your doctor and say, I need a prescription for
whiskey.
You know, or Castlemaine or something.
Right.
You know.
Stella, whatever your poison.
Yeah,
right,
whatever you go for.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about, you just mentioned something, and I'd like to sort of flesh this out a little.
Mm-hmm.
You call them organic cation transporters. Now, I know there is a class of molecule called an ionophore. Do these take cations like sodium or potassium? Is this what we're talking about, or are we talking about something totally different?
No, they take up sodium, they take up potassium.
So that's what you're talking about,
right,
these type of transporters.
Right, and they're, it always makes me laugh, actually, when I read the literature about these transporters, because they're totally non-selective. They will take up hundreds and hundreds of cations, you know, anything of a certain size, up to about 500 base pairs and 4 angstroms big. So there's a whole slew of cations that these transporters take up. And
so they don't just take up metal ions?
No.
They take big or anything with a positive charge.
Charge on it, right.
Okay, so this is not a size selective in general.
No, it's not. So they're totally
electrostatic interaction.
Right. They're totally non-selective. Oh. And so the thing that makes me laugh is you read about these transporters in the literature, and they're always referred to as polyspecific.
Polyspecific, I love it.
I love it,
right,
yeah.
Which means like non-specific.
Non-specific, yeah, right. They're totally, but I guess polyspecific.
Aren't we guilty in science of not using the English language properly?
Very guilty.
You know, to call it. That's polyselective.
Yes, polyselective.
I've got to read that up at a faculty meeting one day when I can't get agreement in the department. You know, we've
that's
got
right.
Polyselection
selective.
Going on. Okay. So these molecules then are also indicted as being important transporters.
Right.
And also play a role in this whole area of depression.
Exactly. And so this is one of the most exciting projects going on in my lab, at least as far as I'm concerned right now. Because getting back to humans who suffer from depression, there is a polymorphism in the gene that encodes the serotonin transporter.
By that, there's two structural variations or more?
Right, right. So this particular...
When you say polymorphism, okay. I mean, a lot of people will think, well, what does that mean? The different structures
okay.
that you can have. It's the same genetic
it's the same...
material, but it folds differently? Or?
So there's only one gene that codes the serotonin transporter, and this polymorphism occurs in the part of that gene that determines how much of that transporter is going to be produced. So people that have this particular polymorphism called the short allele, or the short polymorphism, cleverly named because these people have half as many serotonin transporters as those who don't carry this polymorphism. And what has now been shown and replicated in numerous clinical studies is that people that carry this S allele polymorphism are far more likely to suffer from depression, and especially if they're exposed to stressful life events as well. And the double whammy for these people is that not only are they more likely to suffer depression, they are very poorly treated. They're very non-responsive to currently available medications. So
they're in deep trouble.
They're in deep trouble, yes.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. We have with us today Professor Lynette Dawes from the University of Texas Health Science Center, San Antonio, Department of Physiology. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Neisel. Of all the pandemics in the world, here's one I didn't know about. Myopia.
Nearsightedness? Are you sure you're not thinking of hyperopia, which I and everyone I know has?
Yeah, it seems everyone I know needs reading glasses, but no. I'm referring to young people who can't see far, and the reason will make a lot of parents shake their heads. Kids are spending too much time indoors.
It's true. For example, in Korea and China, where study time has shot up, 90 and 97% of young people have myopia. 60 years ago, only 10 to 20% of Chinese were myopic.
I know it's tempting to believe too much time hitting the books is the problem, but a study in 2000 disproved this theory. In order to find an answer, scientists in 2007 followed more than 500 8- to 9-year-olds with healthy vision.
After tracking their time outdoors over 5 years, 20% had developed myopia, and it correlated with the little time they spent outdoors. Scientists in Australia confirmed those results with their study of 4,000 students a year later.
Here's the reason. The retina produces and releases more dopamine, a neurotransmitter, during the day to signal the eye to switch from night to day vision. The low light indoors disrupts this cycle, which affects the developing eye. They estimate kids need about 3 hours of outside light daily.
If schools mandated even an hour or an hour and a half outside, that's been shown to reduce the risk of myopia. That's why kids in Australia who spend more time outdoors have lower rates of myopia.
Corrective glasses may improve vision, but not the inner eye, which over time stretches and thins. These kids face a higher risk of eye disorders and even blindness unless we force them outdoors.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Lynette Dawes from the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio. And we're talking about transporters. We're talking about transporters that can affect the levels of serotonin extracellular in the brain, and this is where all of your functioning goes. You may not believe that, but that's where it's all at. You were talking about this particular group of people who are very less prone to be able to be treated because they have this S allele functionality. Tell us, how does that come about? Is that just a different structure than the genetic material, or is there something missing?
Okay, well, there's something missing. So people that carry this S allele, they have fewer base pairs or a deletion in the gene that codes the serotonin transporter. And this deletion causes these people to produce less serotonin transporters. So it's a very common polymorphism. It occurs in about 60% of the Caucasian population.
It does?
It does.
You mean 60% of the Anglos that I meet look like liable to be depressed if I give them an
Well,
S?
So this is, you've noticed the obvious, that not 60% of the people walking around are depressed. So this is another example of the gene by environment influence that I was talking about. So while 60% of the population are walking around with this S allele, only those that have the environmental trigger, so we're using the example of a stressful life event, are likely then, or more likely then, to suffer from depression.
Well, I'm a great fan of something called microscopic reversibility. If you can go up a hill, you can go down a hill. If you go down a hill, you can go up a hill. It's a little energy involved there. So aren't there some examples of life-changing experiences where, in fact, the depression will suddenly go away?
That's highly likely.
Depression doesn't have to be forever.
No.
It doesn't have to, therefore, be medicated.
Correct. I mean, there's a lot of psychotherapies that clinicians use that don't involve any pharmacological intervention at all. So there's all sorts of ways to treat depression. It's just, unfortunately, for these people who carry this S allele, really nothing seems to work at all well for them. They're really stuck.
Once they got to the point of
being depressed. Exactly.
There's no shock treatment to take them the other way. And I don't necessarily mean electrical stimulation and shock treatment, but
No
pleasant cruise they could go on.
No.
This is worth a while. I'm depressed. I think I need some life-changing experience. Can you prescribe
a cruise? Go on a cruise and have that cocktail to increase your serotonin. Yes,
off to Adelaide, off to the Barossa Valley.
Yes, we all wish it was so simple. But, depression is such a complex disorder, and I'm really simplifying it down to just one particular patient population and one particular genetic defect. But it happens to be the one that has received the most attention from the National Institutes of Health as far as trying to find better ways to treat this patient population. And this is one line of research that we're interested in, and this is where these organic cation transporters come up again. As we know, the brain is an incredibly plastic thing, and it will adapt and compensate to almost any insult you can throw at it, be it...
Well, this case of this Congress lady in Arizona, I mean, a bullet goes right through the brain, apparently.
Yes.
And she's making an incredible recovery.
Recovery, yes.
I mean, that gives hope to all of us.
Absolutely. The brain is amazing. I mean, you can really insult the heck out of the brain, and it'll just keep on working just fine.
Yeah. So these organic cation transporters, what's their role in this, do you think?
Well, so we use mouse models to study this human genetic defect. So we can genetically engineer mice to have half as many serotonin transporters, and we use them to then look for perhaps how the brain's compensated for having half as many serotonin transporters from the time of conception. And not surprisingly, the brain sure as heck does quite a nice job to compensate. And it does so by compensating by way of these organic cation transporters, which it then produces more of. So people, if we could extrapolate to humans, we could assume that those with half as many serotonin transporters might have twice as many organic cation transporters to try and keep the balance of serotonin in check. Now, if that all holds true in humans, and our animal studies would certainly have me believe that it's a possibility, the reason why Prozac and drugs of antidepressant drugs of that class don't work in these carriers of the S allele is because they've got all these organic cation transporters sucking all the serotonin up. And so you're not getting this increase in serotonin that you need for therapeutic benefit. So in our mouse model, of course, we went along and did the experiment and gave a blocker of the organic cation transporter to see if it would exert an antidepressant-like effect in our mice. And much to our excitement, it did. So our studies are in the midst now of trying to engineer molecules that are highly selective for these organic cation transporters to block them.
Block them.
Which then could potentially be used in conjunction, either by themselves as an antidepressant medication or in conjunction with Prozac to boost the serotonin levels in these people.
So my colleague, who's often a co-host, would immediately jump in and say, well, you know, what's the commercial possibilities for this? I mean, have you patented
any of... Provisional patent in on this, and we certainly have drug companies very interested in working with us on developing these molecules. So there's exciting times ahead, I hope, for the research in my lab.
Right, and plus, of course, it's going to be great for renewals for NIH proposals.
Exactly, which I'm working on right this moment, as it turns out.
Right. One key breakthrough in science is often... opens up a Pandora's box of wonderful possibilities.
I am hoping.
Tell me, you can bioengineer these mice with half the amount of serotonin transporters. Can you presumably also genetically modify a mouse to have twice as many serotonin transporters? And what happens in those cases?
In fact, you can. Not me personally, because that's outside my area of expertise, but there is a group... NIH, or National Institute of Mental Health, were the people who engineered the serotonin transporter deficient mouse group.
So it was done at the NIH campus
in
Bethesda.
Right.
Okay.
By Dennis Murphy, very famous man. Then a group in England, headed by Trevor Sharp, I believe, made a serotonin transporter knock-in mouse. And so this is a mouse that overexpresses a serotonin transporter, and it displays a happy phenotype, if you will. So the animals, they don't get stressed out as easily as the serotonin transporter deficient mice.
And do they have the same, I was going to say work ethic. I don't know what work ethic is for a mouse. But do they seem lively enough to be a regular, good old-fashioned mouse and go out and reproduce?
Actually both, whether they're serotonin transporter deficient or overexpressing the transporter, they're physiologically just fine. They reproduce fine. You can knock the whole gene out and you can still be fine.
I mean, often you think... And probably I'm totally wrong in thinking this, but people who are depressed tend to be less active.
Right.
Well, I mean, I've seen this from friends and family members that, if you're depressed, you just don't get much done.
Right.
I mean, I don't know if that's a fair statement to make for all people who are depressed, but these mouse models, they don't seem to suffer that way.
That you have to push them to see the phenotype. So,
is that reversible then? When you say you push them.
By push them behaviorally. So for the serotonin transporter deficient mouse, it just under normal conditions, you wouldn't be able to tell it apart from a normal mouse. But if you give it a mild stress, it then will become very inactive. It will retreat. So you can, by just some fairly modest environmental manipulation, you can then very easily see the difference in behavioral phenotypes between a normal mouse and a mouse deficient.
And you easily bring this one back?
Yes, you can. You can.
Okay, so this is one of these reversible.
Right.
In that particular. And do you think that would apply to all animal models, like humans too?
It might. Of course, we're very limited in what we can do with humans in terms of any genetic manipulation. That's still many decades away, I think.
Obviously, animal studies is a very controversial area.
Yes.
I mean, for me, it's common sense, but for other people, it's totally abhorrent. What's the best model that you can use for humans? Obviously, you're going to go to primates. I mean, I think that simply because they're too big, too rare, and too wonderful by themselves.
Well, you'd be surprised. There are several groups, large groups with lots of money, using primate models. And the very cool
thing...
You
mean, do they genetically modify primates?
To my knowledge, no one's gone in and done genetic modification of primates, but...
I would have some ethical
issues with that.
I mean, I don't quite know where I can draw the line, if it's a matter of size. I mean, I'll squash a cockroach without thinking. I don't kick a dog without thinking, but I'll kick a dog if I have to.
Right.
You know, but I wouldn't kick a wolf or something bigger.
I tell you, the ethical, the animal ethics committees and the form work and what you need to do to work with primates is horrendous.
I direct a small, it's not so small, but, you know, medium-sized grant here on NIH. And all the participants have to participate in ethics courses.
Right.
Rigorously, in fact. We used to do it ourselves as scientists.
Right.
You know, we'd get test cases and we'd do things of this nature and discuss.
Right.
But now I've simply passed it over to people in the philosophy department to talk about ethics on a much bigger, wider scale.
Right.
And then come back and look at more specifics. You have to do similar things?
Very much so. I mean, the ethics is a big focus. People funded by the National Institutes of Health have to show very detailed evidence of having ethical approval to work with animals of any description. And the bigger the animal.
Or just to do any biomedical research without animals.
Right, exactly. It's. It has to be. It can be time-consuming and tedious dealing with all the paperwork, but it's a must to have that to make sure that the animals we use.
But you have
science.
A special group within the UT system down there to do the paperwork
to oversee
for you
that,
and write
yes,
and come in.
Because
otherwise, if you're any faculty member like all the faculty members I know, you'd get hopelessly lost.
Yes.
Did I do this? Did I cross the right,
things
of that nature.
Exactly. But these monkeys, the non-human primate models, have been an outstanding asset to studying this S allele because the monkeys actually have the same genetic defect as humans. So they're.
You mean 60% of them?
Yes, yes. And they have exactly the same.
Well, let me just back off a minute because you mentioned 60% of Caucasians or Anglos. What about African Americans or Chinese or
I think African Americans, you're asking me to strain my memory. African Americans, the frequency is less. I think it's down around 20 to 30%.
Okay.
And Japanese, I believe it's much higher, about 80%.
Aye, interesting.
Yeah, it's very, it varies.
I mean, is there a big profile of racial background, ethnic racial background to depression?
Now, that's something I really should be able to give you an answer to, but I think for sure depression is more prevalent in Western society.
Right.
And that kind of isn't surprising given the fast lifestyles we have.
You do think that the lifestyle is the major feature for triggering all this depression?
I
never met too many depressed people in Australia, I got to say that. Lynette Dawes, University of Texas Health Science Center, San Antonio. Thank you so much for being here. It's been great fun.
Thank you very much.
All right. And Norma Martinez, thank you for editing all this and making it all appear so beautiful. At least I hope it's beautiful. And to the audience, we'll see you next week again. Bye-bye.